Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
The truth. And now here's Guy James.
Thank you. Everybody take your seats. Please calm down. Yes, thank you. I'm pointing as I say that and nodding. Thank you. Yes. Welcome to the Guy James Show. I have a warped sense of humor, don't I? I love the way the politicians do that. Do you ever see that, how they go out and stand on the stage and point and nod, but not really pointing at anybody? That's just their way of, letting them know that they're up there. Hey, we got a couple of great guests for you coming up today. We've got Tom Engelhardt of TomDispatch.com. He's going to be with us to talk about all these bases over in Iraq that people don't want to talk about very much. And then coming up in the second hour, we have somebody we've had before, Elizabeth De La Vega. She's a former federal prosecutor, and we're going to talk about the Kucinich impeachment articles. And so we'll do that in the second hour, and we got Tom Engelhardt of TomDispatch.com coming up in the first hour. That should keep you informed and entertained all day long, okay? We'll try and do that today. This is Guy James coming to you from the Blue Waters and Sandy Beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida, Fort Myers and Naples area, streaming all around the country, all around the world. So glad to have all of you along with us. And if you should want to join the program today, you can do that. 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. Almost forgot the phone number there for a minute. I don't know. One of those days. I might as well get to this. Get this over with, so I can get it off my chest and get my blood to stop boiling. I'm sure many of you by now have seen or heard about at least the Michelle Malkin moment on Fox News last night. One of my favorite pieces, Michelle Malkin. Whew, boy, Michelle Malkin. You take her and Ann Coulter and put them together. I don't know which one of them is the most despicable. I really don't. But anyway, if you've listened to this program for any length of time at all, you certainly know of my absolute disdain and my revulsion of anything Fox News. They've been the mouthpiece for the Republican Party and the fanatic neocon faction for a long, long time now. And I firmly believe, and I'll always believe, that Rupert Murdoch is a danger to free press in this nation, plain and simple. And when you look at that pathetic network over there, you've got your Hannity and your O'Reilly and your John Gibson, who just got fired recently, Karl Rove, and the nasty little bitch I want to speak about today, and I'm sorry about throwing epithets, but that's how I feel about her. Michelle Malkin was on there last night. She's a columnist that's syndicated in my own newspaper. I have to look at this thing in my own newspaper. But by now, you've all heard about Fox and her little game yesterday, most of you have, calling Michelle Obama a baby mama. That's right. For those of you who don't know, that's been used for years as a term for an unwed mother, a slang term for a woman. In other words, it's not used as a complimentary term. And Michelle was on this program yesterday, and they had the little banner running underneath it that says, Barack's baby mama. But Fox News, during the Michelle Malkin interview yesterday, they had that on the banner, you know, the little ribbon under the talking heads that Fox uses to denigrate people, and then they go back and say, oops, we didn't really mean that. They do that lots of time. My question for Fox News is, why not just do away with the preliminaries? I would respect Fox News a whole lot more if they just come out with it. Just come out with it. Have any of you been in these polite little circles of, I don't want to say friends, but you've been discussing the election this year, and people will, and maybe they don't know you, they don't know my political background, maybe they don't know me at all, and they'll start talking about one candidate or another, and the racist in the group, of whom there usually are some, particularly where I live. And if that's an indictment on the place where I live, do not forget that this town, Fort Myers, was listed about 10 years ago as the most segregated city in the United States. But it goes without saying that you're around people at the water cooler or where you work or whatever, wherever you're around, and there's always that insinuation. Or someone will come right out and say the word when we're talking about somebody of another race. You know what I'm saying. I would respect people a whole lot more if they just came out with it, if they weren't coy, if they didn't play these little games like Fox News does. Why not say what you mean when it comes to Barack Obama and Michelle Obama? Why the baby mama stuff? Why not just lay it out and be right up front with the public, Fox News? We know what you're getting at. We know what your message about the Obamas is to your audience of slugs and uneducated fools. We know all about that. Why not just do it? And if I offend somebody, I'm sorry. But Fox News, why don't you just call Michelle Obama and Barack Obama what you really want to call them? Why don't you call them what some of these people are thinking? They won't say out loud to one another what they're saying. Some of them do say out loud. Let me write it for you. Let me write your news line for you, Fox News. Breaking news. Barack and Michelle Obama are niggers. Why don't you just say it like it is? Why don't you just say it like you mean it instead of trying to be cute? That's what you're thinking. That word offends people, but it wouldn't offend the viewers of Fox News, not one bit. They'd be sitting on their sofa with their beer and their tater chips, and they hear that comment and say, damn, I love that Fox News. They tell it like it is. They'd stand up and salute the Confederate flag that's hanging on your trailer wall and say, thank God for Fox News. You think I'm kidding about this? Not a single word. You want to say it? I know you do. If you could find any possible way to slip it in, you would. It's your game, Fox News. It's your style. It's your network's morality. I've heard it over and over again. Which is why it's absolutely imperative that these haters be regularly defined as the ignorant, no-good cowards they really are. They're lower than rats. They're cavemen, too. Just two hopelessly stupid to comprehend that they've outlived their era. We've all heard that. I've heard it the last time I was in Washington from some civilized people. You've heard it. I've heard it. Don't you worry. It's alive and well in this country. I happen to think Michelle Obama is a highly respected woman. I think she has great love and respect for her country. I think she has great love and respect for her husband. And I think she will make a very fine first lady. A very fine first lady. One that I certainly would be proud of. So, Fox, and you neocons and you Republicans that like to denigrate people of another race, those of you that won't be satisfied with anybody as president unless they're an old white guy, tough. Eat it. You're going to have to for quite a few years coming up. 866-546-5254. Love to have you join the program today. Love to know if you have a comment. Love to know if you hear those kinds of comments. I do. All the time. And they won't come out and say the word sometime, but, you know, they say, well, we can't have one of those people as the President of the United States. What would everybody think? We're not ready for that. You know, what happens if one of them gets in there as the President of the United States and then, you know, start appointing everybody in every office everywhere, just make them all black people, you know, and then it's going to, we white folks, we're going to take a back seat, you know, and that just wouldn't be right. It just wouldn't be right to have people. It just doesn't seem right having a black man in there as president. It just doesn't look right. And I've even had people say to me, you know, Barack is not so bad. You know, he's half white and he's half black, and so he's fairly light-skinned. But gee, you know, that wife of his, she is really black. Boy, I don't know about having her in the White House. Have any of you heard this from people? I have. Oh, I have. And I'll listen to it for a moment or two, and then the guns come out blazing, and I explain exactly how I feel about that. I will not, for the sake of being polite, tolerate that from anybody. I mean, anybody. Never. But I always let them just get in the water and start swimming around a little bit. Let them say what they really mean so that there's no mistake here, that you know how they feel, and then start going at them about attitudes like that. It makes me sick. It just absolutely makes me sick. But I would like to know if any of you run into that as well. I do. All the time. And I always make my feelings absolutely clear. And I hope you do as well. I don't know if people can be shamed into being decent or not. I don't know. I think they can, maybe. Let's head on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey there, Guy. Ben Burke.
Hi, Ben.
Well, you know, I actually heard somebody say something, I heard it secondhand. This was somebody I knew who went to the polls in Massachusetts and was accosted by some Hillary supporters out, you know, beyond the legal limit for poll working. And they asked who she was going to vote for. And she said, I'm going to vote for Barack Obama. And Hillary supporters said, well, we don't understand why you'd want to do that. At least she's white.
I don't get it.
I don't get it either. I never have. I never will. I grew up here in Elgin, Illinois, which I hate to tell you is a hotbed for the Illinois Nazis. And my high school was full of Illinois Nazis. And I think they're disgusting.
Well, it just goes to show you that this country, we're still a baby in the world community, older than some and not nearly as old as others. We've got a lot of growing to do. We do. And I think
President Obama will help that along.
I do too. I absolutely do. I believe that he will. And I think he will for all the right reasons. He's not the, I mean, I think people underestimate him. I really do. He's
just between you, me, and the wall, he is a whole lot more liberal than he lets on. But he understands something. In order to get to a place where he can do something about that, he has to play the game.
Well, and he's doing a good job of it so far. I mean, his demeanor is probably perfect for a candidate. He knows when to. I was so impressed with his speech last week when he said that he was the presumptive nominee. That was a magnificent speech. He knows when to let a little fire come out of the belly. He knows when to be calm. And I see that he's going to just stay out of this mess when the rumors and innuendos start. He's just going to kind of stay out of it. So I think he's a pretty damn smart candidate, no doubt about it.
The website Snopes.com does a really good job of debunking all those rumors. I would suggest people go there and read what Ms. Mickelson had to say about them.
Oh, sure. Snopes does a good job. They've settled many an argument for folks that I know of, that's for sure. How are you doing, Ben? How's White Rose Society getting along?
Oh, we're doing good. We're running a fundraiser. And
yeah, tell us about that.
I've recently had some. Yeah, I've been paying out of pocket to keep White Rose running for quite a while now because it doesn't really make what it costs. And recently I've had some rather large bills, and I've got to pay them. And in order to do that, one thing or the other has to happen. Either people have to step up and help me out with White Rose, or I'm going to have to stop doing it.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's simple as that.
And they can help out the cause by...
Well, if they go to the main page at www.whiterosesociety.org, they will find a link to the donate page, and they can donate there via PayPal, and there's an address at the bottom of that page if they want to just send a check or money order.
Great. Well, I hope everybody does. You know, I'm not sure. I think most of my audience knows how much you mean to the liberal progressive cause, how much you've done over the years, and... it's greatly appreciated by myself, I know that, and Ben's been an ally with us for a long, long time, and it's greatly appreciated. WhiteRoseSociety.org, and just get on over there. You can find where to donate and help out with this, because, hey, this equipment that Ben uses and we all use, it's not cheap stuff. And
I've got six servers that I have online. I have to pay monthly rental on, and... my electric bills, you wouldn't believe what they are.
Sure.
Because I've got a whole bunch of machines running here just to record shows. So.
Yeah, well, they heat up.
Some of them are wearing out, which is...
They do, don't they?
They? If you leave them on 24/7 and use them all the time, it's amazing how quick computers wear out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Ben, I hope that goes well for you. And
I think it will. We're about a fifth of the way to the goal at this point. We've only been doing it for 2 days.
So. Oh, good.
I think we'll get through this pretty quick.
Don't hesitate to remind us again, Ben.
I won't. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Ben.
Bye-bye.
Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Ben provides a great service for you, to all of us. And we appreciate it oh so much. Oh so much. Ben has probably done more to... get listeners for the progressive liberal cause than anybody I can think of. And he's been at it a long time and knows what he's doing, and a great tech guy, and we appreciate being brothers in arms with Ben Birch. That's a fact. And please do that. Go to WhiteRoseSociety.org and help out with that. Doesn't have to be a lot. Whatever you can afford. If you can afford a few extra bucks, help out with it. Does cost money to keep all the equipment running. 866-546-5254. We've once again coming up at the bottom of the hour. We got Tom Englehart coming up. Tom, the guy who runs TomDispatch.com, He got a new book out, The World According to Tom Dispatch, America in the New Age of Empire, and it's a dandy, and you'll want to know about that. Hey, you want to see something that's a lot of fun, a lot of fun. A friend of mine, Dan Wolkoff, sent this to me, and I hope Dan doesn't mind me mentioning his name, but he sent this to me, and maybe you've seen it before, I don't know, but take this down. Please take this down, and I'll type it on the chat room, www.bush-mccain-challenge.com. You need to go over there and take this test. I know you'll enjoy it. You will. And you'll learn something, too, while you're doing it. All right? That's at www.bush-mccainchallenge.com. And I think you'll find everything you need right on there. And take that test. You should. I think you'll enjoy it. I know I did. Oh, talk to one of my radical friends here in the last couple of days. I shouldn't put it that way. I should say Republican friends. And, you know, it's just hard to listen to. And it makes you want to bang your head against the wall. It does me. Everybody, every time somebody starts in this, well, I've done it. Why can't they do it? Not recognizing that there are circumstances and not recognizing that we're all a little different. And it doesn't mean that somebody that works hard can't fall on hard times and lose their job and can't find another one with the same benefits and or any benefits. Now, it's tough out there right now. It's extremely tough. But you hear it. No, the economy's fine with me. Get another job. Get an extra job. Get a job with benefits. Sell your house and move. Cut back on expenses. I did it. You can do it. Yada, 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 yada. Well, that works. All of that works. But when you've done that and you're still under the boot, it doesn't make you feel so good. Now, does it? And I know there's some folks listening that know exactly what I'm talking about. I know that some of you have lost your jobs. I know some of you can't find another job with benefits. Jobs with benefits are pretty much going out the window now. Even if you do find one that gives you some insurance benefits, you usually have to pay a considerable portion of it. Instead of $1,000 a month, you only have to pay $500. You know, when you're working on a job that pays $8, $9, $10 an hour, or even $12, it's hard to pay $400 or $500 a month for insurance. Very hard. And then we've got this economy where people would like to move and get a different job, but they can't sell their home. They're tied down by the home, and it's tougher and tougher all the time to go get another mortgage. What do? You're paying a mortgage on a house. You rent it. Many times let somebody destroy it for you after you move out. That happens all the time. Meanwhile, you go someplace else and rent a house. Chancy on whether or not you get a good job or keep a good job wherever you're at. And please let me know where those good jobs are. I know the Guardian Glass Company in Indiana just closed another plant, And sure, they take care of some of their execs. They take care of some of the people that are well paid in the plant, but the people in the plant, the workers, the people that make the money, too bad. Same thing going on with Whirlpool Corporation. Same thing's going on with the Timken Corporation. Same thing going on with a lot of companies that I know quite a bit about. And if you're a regular guy raising a couple kids, maybe you've got some sickness in the family. Maybe you've got a pre-existing condition and you're on your job and you've got an insurance plan and you lose that job and you go and you try and get another insurance plan someplace else with a pre-existing condition. Guess what's going to happen to you? You're not going to get accepted. It's tough. It's really tough. And I don't want to be the purveyor of doom and gloom on this show every day. We'd like to talk about politics, and the economy is germane to the political race that's taking place right now. It's completely germane to that. You can trace much of this stuff right back to George W. Bush's door. You can trace much of the increase in the price of gasoline right back to George Bush's door because of the war in Iraq, the occupation of Iraq. You can trace a lot of the price of the $4 gasoline right now to the door of George W. Bush for threatening Iran constantly and causing an uproar in the market. Threatening Iran with a military strike. We'll talk about that a little later on in the program, just exactly where is that situation. But none of that does the oil market any good. It's all helped raise the prices. And we've gone on ad infinitum about the price of gasoline and what it's done to the economy on this program, and we'll continue to do it. Because it has such an enormous effect on us all. Does on me, does on you, does on everybody. 866-546-5254. We're going to pause for a break in just a minute or so. You're already paying at least $4 for a gallon of gas. It went up another nickel just yesterday, a lot of places, with a gallon of self-serve regular averaging $4.05 across the country. In less than 6 months, it's gone up by a buck. The cost of crude today, last I looked, is down around, $1.34, $1.35 a barrel. They're saying that gas should top out at about $4.15 this summer. I'll believe that when I see it. And, of course, any excuse you want to name, declining gas inventories, the disruption of supplies in the Gulf of Mexico because of the hurricane season, the volatility in the Middle East, someone took a shot at the pipeline, yada, 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 goes on and on and on. That could make the 415 seem like a low estimate. And the best scenario presented by the government is the price should remain about $4 for the remainder of the year, and maybe even fall down to $3.92. Can you imagine gas under $4 a gallon? And yes, Ray on the chat room does remind me that Rupert Murdoch, the mogul of the media, the genius, said that the Iraq War, when they were out there pumping that Iraq War for the Bush administration, shoveling the crap for the Bush administration every single day, reading off of the script the Bush administration sent them every day, Rupert Murdoch predicted that the Iraq War would bring the price of oil down to $20 a barrel. How about that? How's that working for you, Rupert? Not so well that I can see. We're going to pause for a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't you dare go anywhere. You understand? Okay.
Anyone with a heart
And we're back. Welcome back to the Guy James Show. Good to have all of you along with us this afternoon. And as promised, I don't know how many of you take a look at a lot of different websites every day. I do, and I've got about a couple of dozen that I like to visit every day because, well, because they're damn good. That's why. And I can learn something from them, and I can get the straight information. I've learned over the years where, you know, what I can believe and what I can't. And a guy that runs a great website, Tom over at TomDispatch.com, and I know many, many, many of you are familiar with TomDispatch.com. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Guy.
Really great to have you on with us today. And before we get anything done, I know many of you are aware of the fact that Tom is an author, and he's got a new book out called The World According to Tom Dispatch, America in the New Age of Empire. It's just hard to believe that somebody would think that we're any kind of an imperialistic empire-type country, but
it's true. Ever since the neocons stopped talking about us as the new Rome or the next Great Britain on whom the sun would never set, you can't believe it anymore.
Yeah. Hey, and we'll mention that again before we...
They stopped when Iraq went south.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, if it weren't so... I'd cry.
If it weren't so grim, it would be truly...
Yes, it would.
It's really grim, yeah.
Tom, as you and I discussed, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the program today, and it's about something that I'm sure a lot of people just aren't very familiar about. We've heard rumors, we've heard a little of this and a little of that about it, but I wanted to talk to you today, and I know you've learned a lot about the subject of these bases that we've got in Iraq. They're bigger, more of them, what our future usage is of them and all that. It's got me a bit worried.
Yeah, they're remarkable. I mean, we have built over the last 5 years, the Pentagon has built in Iraq, thanks to the old Halliburton Division, KBR. They've built these. They're basically American towns. They're enormous. They're 15 to 20 miles around. They've got double PXs. They've got bus routes. They've got traffic lights. You can get speeding tickets on some of them. I mean, this is extraordinary in a country like Iraq, where, of course, if you have a traffic light, there may be no electricity. So let's just take one, Balad, which is about 80 kilometers north of Baghdad. It's a big air base, holds about 40,000 troops, contractors, Defense Department people, and so on and so forth. It has air traffic at the level, they say, of Heathrow Airport or O'Hare in Chicago. Guy Raz, the NPR defense correspondent, visited it last year, and he said it was lit up at night. Again, in a country basically without electricity a lot of the time, it was lit up like Las Vegas. It was a giant construction site. Billions and billions of dollars have gone into these bases that have, the Pentagon, of course, will not use the word permanent. They won't use them about any of our bases on Earth. But and they used to charmingly call these bases enduring camps, which kind of has that summery flavor to it. These are enormous, basically permanent structures on the Iraqi landscape. We have about 30 major bases there. About five of them are these mega bases, including Camp Victory outside Baghdad. Now, hundreds of thousands of Americans, troops, obviously, contractors and so on and so forth, have gone through them, but congressional delegations, presidential candidates, and correspondents. So you see correspondents at Camp Victory, you know, talking about the Iraqi situation, but the camera never pans. So the strange thing is there have been a few articles written about them in our press, almost nothing, but a couple of good articles. Tom Ricks did a good one for the Washington Post back in 2006 on Balad. But basically, I think you could make the claim that Americans on television, where they get most of their news, have never seen what these things we've built with billions of dollars and are upgrading at this second look like.
Man, you're talking to traffic like Heathrow or O'Hare. You're talking about an airport that's bigger than Baghdad International, certainly.
Much bigger. Much bigger. And with heavily reinforced runways. I mean, these are enormous, enormous guarded structures. And of course there's one more base in Iraq that very little is said about, and that's the huge embassy that we're building for 1,000 supposed diplomats in the middle of the green zone. It's almost the size of the Vatican. It has its own power supply, its own anti-missile system, a defenses and so on and so forth. It's an enormous thing. It's functionally a base inside the fortified citadel of the Green Zone in the middle of the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. It's cost $750 million and still going up, yet to be occupied, but soon.
You know, Tom, it's fascinating to me that the American public does know about this embassy, and they know about the cost overruns. They should, anyway, if they don't. And yet we have people who still believe, that still are part of those 28%ers that I like to talk about, that still believe that we're there for this noble purpose, and we're going to get out sometime soon, and yet we have all these indicators, like these bases, and this Green Zone, that say absolutely the contrary. So it's completely the other direction.
That's right. And, you know, the strip, for the first time, I mean, basically for the last 5 years, these bases have hardly made it, I think largely thanks to, I mean, the Bush administration really doesn't want Americans to know about them. Because, in fact, whenever on rare occasions, Americans are asked by pollsters if they want permanent bases in Iraq, by large majorities they don't, for obvious reasons and for sane reasons. But what the Bush administration has tried to do, that's actually for the first time forced this subject into the news in the last few days, is they're doing a kind of, they call it a SOFA agreement, a status of forces agreement, which is something we have with about 80 countries around the world for how to base our military in a foreign country and what rights they have, and so on and so forth. But in this particular agreement, in the midst of a war with 160,000 troops and all those contractors there, is really almost the equivalent, it really is the equivalent of a treaty. They claim it's not because they don't want to bring it before Congress. But it will be an agreement with another framework going with it if the Iraqis are willing to sign it, and there's a lot of opposition in Iraq now, that would really potentially tie the hands of any new president coming into office. You know, it really would embed these very permanent structures in the future of Iraq with the American troops that went with them. So, I mean, they're really trying to embed their own version of Iraq in the next administration, whether it's McCain or Obama. And that, I think, is causing problems here. The Senate, the Congress has started to react somewhat angrily because they're not getting information on this, and they do feel it could rise to the level of a treaty, and that this administration could be making commitments that really are only supposed to be made with the Senate's advice and consent.
And we won't be able to get out of them if it's not a treaty and it's not before the Congress. Bush can make a deal that we're pretty much stuck with.
He could. I mean, you know, obviously a new president, I would have some maneuvering room, but I think basically their idea is to try to stick the next president with these bases and with a kind of permanency in Iraq that certainly an Obama presidency, at least theoretically, wouldn't want. I mean, if we were to believe what he says, and you know, the problem is, as has been true in the past, in their demands on the Iraqis, they have been so greedy. They have demanded immunity for, I mean, in the initial rounds of these talks before the Iraqis, I mean, almost across the board, began to get angry about this, even the ones we were supporting. They were demanding control of Iraqi airspace to 29,000 feet. They were demanding immunity for American contractors and soldiers wherever they might be in Iraq. They were basically demanding the right to move American troops without the Iraqis knowing about it, to move them into the country without their knowing about it, and possibly even originally to launch attacks on other countries from Iraq without the permission of the Iraqis. Now, on some of this, they've had to start backing down because the Iraqis have basically surprised them this is a hard world. This is the problem the Bush people have had almost from the beginning. The world at present, it's very hard to go into a hostile country and, in essence, take sovereignty from that country.
You know, absolutely.
We're not in the 19th century anymore. It's very hard to garrison another country, you know, where it's obvious that you are taking sovereignty from that country. It gets people's backs up, just as if, you know, a bunch of Iranians or Iraqis came here and built huge bases and tried to strong-arm such an agreement.
And that's in an area of the world, people that have long memories of this type of thing, this garrisoning that you're talking about and all, that has taken place many times in that area of the world in the past.
Absolutely.
And they're using almost extortion on them with their money.
Yeah. This is a very interesting situation. And Patrick Coburn, a wonderful reporter, British reporter, who's been an independent in Iraq and has done great reporting, recently wrote a piece saying because Iraq was basically declared an outlaw nation under Saddam and remains theoretically in that state via the UN, it's not been changed. The money from Iraqi oil basically goes into U.S. banks, and it's held there, and then the present Iraqi government can ask for it. But we're talking about $50 billion. There are also a lot of legal judgments against Saddam's regime here in this country, adding up to about $20 billion. Right now, those legal judgments cannot take that $20 billion. But the Bush administration has been threatening the Iraqis that if they don't sign this agreement, they'll basically let the legal judgments go ahead, and they would promptly lose, in essence, $20 billion. So this is really a kind of strong-arming. They're pushing hard, and the remarkable thing is the Iraqis seem not, at this point, across the board, Sunni, Shiite, Iranian backers, Iranian haters, it almost doesn't matter. The Kurds, there may be a slightly different story. Are horrified and angry by this, and the Bush administration, under the pressure from Iraq, from its own allies in Iraq, and also from Congress, is beginning to at least pull back cosmetically. They still basically want the same thing. So it's a very dangerous situation, I think, a very, very, because it could lock us into what the American people have uniformly, minus your 28%, maybe it's even 25%, because I noticed that CBS, the latest CBS poll had Bush's job approval rating at 25%.
Oh.
Maybe that's being nibbled away, but minus that 28%, it is remarkable, and it's been remarkable since 2005, that Americans, you know, by a significant majority, either want to be out of Iraq yesterday or in a reasonable period of time. And, of course, that's a reasonable thing to want.
It's and most certainly is, unless you're John McCain, and
yeah.
And it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
These bases, going back to these bases, you said there are many, but there are, what, four or five or six very big ones?
Five or six big ones, yeah.
And I assume there's
huge ones.
You can actually see where they're at. What's that website I'm trying to think of?
If you go to Google Earth.
Yeah.
You can see, they're big enough to see. You could see them just the same way you could see a small town in the American Midwest. I mean, for instance, there's a base out, a marine base out in the western desert called Al Asad. Now the president landed there to meet Maliki because it's obviously very secure. It's about, you know, 18 to 20 miles around. They brought in rent-a-cops from Africa to run the traffic. The troops nicknamed it Camp Cupcake because of the amenities. You know, they're I mean, I'm sure it's no pleasure to be there, I'm sure, but nonetheless, soldiers have a sardonic way of dealing with the world, and that's their nickname for it. You know, that has there are fast, you know, subways and Pizza Huts and, you know, I don't know, you know, Burger Kings. I'm not sure which of these are at which bases, but they, you know, PX, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the president landed there. The press landed with him. Again, the shots you saw on TV, it was nighttime. The president came down. He could have been coming down anywhere. But never do those cameras pan. So, I've been following this for years, and I have yet to see actual video of these bases. I've seen some shots. But it is amazing to think that the American taxpayer has pulled multi-billion, we don't know how many billions, but staggering billions, into building these things thousands of miles away, and they cannot see them. And the media in essence, has basically the mainstream media has not covered it. You really have to go online to see most of it.
Well, I'm not sure we really have a mainstream media anymore.
Whatever it is.
Well, exactly. And isn't this now one of the ways of the Bush administration to try and make these things palatable for the American people? Did I hear something or other about how they're maybe thinking about leasing these to the Iraqis?
Yeah, they're now talking about this would be a kind of this would be, you know, one cosmetic way to go. You'd have an extra part of a perimeter fence with maybe a couple of Iraqi guards, and it would be called an Iraqi base. We would lease it, you know, I don't know, for $1 or $1 million, you know, whatever it would be. Of course, we'd then be renting it. We'd be renting these huge things that we've built from the Iraqis.
Yes.
And it would ostensibly remain Iraqi sovereignty, Iraqi territory. But this sort of thing really is, at this point, is cosmetic. Because, you know, there's a limited degree to which the U.S. military is obviously not going to work under Iraqi command. Now, this is just one part of the way that the Bush administration has been, you know, extending the war beyond its own time in office. I mean, for instance, they've been. I saw the other day, you know, a contract to upgrade one of these bases. You know, it's like maybe $40 or $50 million, and it's through 2009. This is the Pentagon contract just released. The State Department has just done contracts to send advisors. I forget what they call them, kind of a sweet phrase, but I forget what it is. But they're, in essence, advisors to go into probably the Interior Department, the Iraqi Interior Department, to work with people there. Again, through 2009. Defense Department, the same thing is going to happen. Their Defense Department, not ours. I mean, in other words, really, they don't control their own Interior and Defense Department completely. They're Americans positioned in there just the same as their Americans. The Iraqi army is really an army that relies on American, you know, American supplies and so on and so forth. It's not really an independent army.
Oh, certainly not. Certainly not. Tom, I know your time's limited today. The book, you want to give us a quickie outline of the book?
Sure. Well, what I would say about the book, it's called The World According to Tom Dispatch. And it's really, I would say the sad thing about the book is that it's a collection of the best articles from, you know, people like Chalmers Johnson, Michael Clare, Rebecca Solnit, all sorts of interesting experts who have written original pieces for Tom Dispatch, and even the oldest pieces, like if you take Chalmers Johnson, he's the fellow who put blowback into our language with his book Blowback, did a piece called Smash of Civilization, which is about what happened when we sent our troops into Baghdad and defended the oil ministry but didn't bother to patrol the, you know, hospitals, schools, or the museums that held the earliest patrimony of humanity. We still haven't come to grips with stories like this, so that when you read them, even the older ones, and most of them are much more recent, they're painfully up to date. Because the book is really a series of articles about the missing stories from our world. I mean, to just take one example and then I'll stop. We've talked about the mega bases which are in it, but air war. You know, we've heard for a year and a half about the president's surge in Iraq, and all that refers to is the 30,000 ground troops who moved in almost a year ago, and that's a surge that's been ebbing for a while. However, the air surge in Iraq not only has gone on for the last year, but it continues to go on. In other words, the air surge isn't over yet. It's almost unwritten about. It's a story that Tom Dispatch has followed. I've followed air power in Iraq since the beginning, and I've always found it strange that reporters who go out on boats on the Tigris or out with patrols and so on never seem to look up. It's these sorts of stories in The World According to Tom Dispatch that you'll find that give you a kind of an alternate view, an alternative history of the mad Bush years.
Excellent. And in our second hour today, we're going to have a friend of yours and mine both on, Elizabeth De La Vega, is going to be on with us today to talk about Dennis Kucinich's latest antics. I shouldn't say antics, actions is what I really mean.
Yeah.
So we're looking forward to that today, too.
Fabulous.
She posts on your site now and then, doesn't she?
She did for a long time. I mean, she hasn't done something recently, but she's great.
Okay.
And we actually did a book together called The USD George Bush et al.
Oh, yes, I have that. I'm looking at it right here in my bookshelf.
There you are. So say hello for me.
Tom, thanks so much for being on the program today. Again, everybody, that's tomdispatch.com. I'm sure most of you have been there, but if you haven't, you really need to visit tomdispatch.com. And, of course, the information about the book will be on there as well. Tom Engelhardt, thanks so much for being on the program today.
And thanks for having me, Guy.
Bye now.
Bye.
Tom has a great website. If you don't visit that one often, you really should. TomDispatch.com. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with you in just a moment or two, and I expect you'll be here too.
The fairy tale, you can take the future, even if you fail. I believe in angels, something good in everything I see. I believe in angels, when I know the time.
Dream.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Man, a little ABBA always does my heart good. I love ABBA. Oh, yes, I do. Call me what you want. I don't care. I like it. I think they're way ahead of their time. You know something I was thinking about? I read an old quote. And get this, a conversation between Tim Russert and Senator McCain. Russert says, the fact is, you are different from George Bush. And McCain said, no. The fact is that I'm different, but the fact is that I have agreed with President Bush far more than I've disagreed. And on transcendent issues, the most important issues of our day, I've been totally in agreement and in support of President Bush. And so McCain went on to list the issues where he'd been in agreement with Bush: the war on terror, the war in Iraq, national security, national defense, support of men and women in the military, fiscal discipline, and a number of other issues. And asked whether he'd be interested in Cheney had the vice president not already served two terms, McCain said, well, I don't know if I would want him as vice president. He and I have the same strengths, but to serve in other capacities, hell yeah. Well, that right there eliminates you from consideration, Mr. Bush, Mr. McCain, amongst other things, if you would have Dick Cheney in here. And he goes on to say, you know what he just goes on as a complete idiot. But what I want to say is, I've done an awful lot of research in the past several months on John McCain. And I suggest everybody should, so that you can counter the arguments that come from those on the right that support him and make the arguments to those who are undecided about his absolute, he's unqualified to be the President of the United States. In no way should he be President of the United States. But you know what I've discovered while doing a tremendous amount of research on John Sidney McCain? And I don't mean this in any sort of an insult to him personally. I really don't. But it's become very, very obvious to me that the man isn't very bright. He's wily, he's clever, he's sneaky, yes. But bright? No. Positively not. In fact, I don't think he's as bright as George W. Bush, and that's saying something. And I mean that. I'm serious about it. I'm not making a joke. I've listened to him. I've heard his speeches. I've read many of his writings, his positions on things. And the guy just isn't very bright. I'm sorry. But that's how he comes off. And if you can't speak at all, if you can't make cogent points to people, which he usually cannot, if you can't write in a understandable way, you are probably not bright enough to be the President of the United States. And having gone through that now for 8 years, I don't think that's something we need to deal with again, do you? Does that surprise you that I would say that? Have you heard anybody else say that? You may not like the guy, you may not like his policies, you may not like many things he's done, but have you heard anybody say that they didn't think he's very bright? Honestly, I do feel that way, and I'm not saying that to say anything, controversial or anything like that. It's just that he's not very bright, and he isn't competent enough to be the President of the United States. There's no way. No way. Not even close. But then again, you look at these, we'll be using Junior Bush as a benchmark for many, many years, comparing people to Junior Bush. And I really believe Junior Bush is smarter than John McCain. And that's not a hell of a good comment to John McCain, I guess. I don't know. And I don't think I'm giving Junior Bush too much credit either, because as you all know, the man, it's magic that he got into office. It's fraud that he got into office in the first place. But here's a man that had no business ever being a governor or a president of the United States. He had no business ever being in any leadership position that I can think of whatsoever. But somehow, he did it. I don't know. Hey, we're going to pause for news. At the top of the hour, you're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, Billy Shears, music director, and we're going to be back right after the news.
listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, is out with a report on how state attorneys general have handled the mortgage foreclosure crisis. ACORN says that a handful of states, including Illinois, stand out for their A-plus efforts to protect people from predatory lending. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan says while state responses are important, the magnitude of this foreclosure crisis for working families demands a federal solution.
We really do need a comprehensive plan at the federal level, one that is going to combine funding for loan modifications on a massive scale with meaningful reforms of the mortgage lending industry. Many, many states that have taken decisive action and have committed substantial resources in response to the foreclosure crisis.
ACORN says in its report that it's pleased with progress that state attorneys general are making in trying to respond to the mortgage foreclosure crisis and to take steps to prevent it from happening again. Madigan says she and her colleagues will continue their work at the state level, but they're also looking to Washington for help.
We're closely watching the efforts of our elected officials in Washington as they work to pass a legislative package that will bolster our state-level efforts to help hardworking families hold on to the dream of home ownership.
The United Steelworkers and the Sierra Club are working toward a future of green jobs for America in the Blue-Green Alliance as we wrestle with finding a solution to global warming. Dave Foster is executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance and a former steelworkers official. He says the Labor Environmental Alliance is pursuing its Green Jobs for America campaign to help achieve a sustainable future, both for the environment and for jobs. Foster says the Blue-Green Alliance is working to create a 21st century New Deal for the global economy, just as the World War II generation created a New Deal for the national economy. To build a green future, Foster says, traditional unionized jobs from carpenters to sheet metal workers to steel workers will be needed. The United Auto Workers Union has decided to endorse Senator Barack Obama for president. In a statement released Tuesday, UAW President Ron Gettelfinger said that, quote, after a historic primary campaign which activated and mobilized millions of voters, our union is proud to endorse Senator Barack Obama. Gettelfinger said Obama has inspired our country with a positive vision for a better America and with concrete plans to turn that vision into reality. Here's today's economic report. Barack Obama says the economic suffering of working people is directly tied to trickle-down style economic policies supported by George W. Bush and John McCain. Obama wants a government infusion of $50 billion more into the economy, an extension of unemployment benefits, more rebate checks to taxpayers, and an end to the Bush tax breaks for the wealthy. McCain wants to keep the Bush tax cuts and the tax breaks for big oil, and he opposes any more government money being pumped into the ailing economy. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey, John, I just heard you got a new computer. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's the coolest thing.
What will you do with your old computer?
I don't know. I guess I'll just throw it away.
Well, my company just bought new computers, and we decided to donate the old PCs to a place that gives them to local schools. You can do something like that?
Seriously, who would want a 3-year-old computer?
Hey, it might be great for someone else. Computers can be refurbished and reused instead of ending up in the trash. By passing it on, you can help the community and the environment.
If you're replacing your company's IT equipment or you're finished using your personal computer, pass it on to a local organization that accepts computers. To learn more, log on to epa.gov/pass it on. This message was brought to you by EPA, Dell, Intel, HP, NEC, Philips, and this radio station on behalf of EPA's Plug Into eCycling Partnership. EPA does not endorse any commercial services or products of these groups. For information on all partners, log on to epa.gov/plugin.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
The Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, they don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Not unless you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year, and a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, Ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run with those scissors...
It's the least you can do.
James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, you hear me? Give my creation! Fly!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
You can count down. 6... 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. I'm feeling frisky today. I hope you are, too. 866-546-5254, if you'd like to join us here in the... well, not in the studio, actually, but on the phone. 866-546-5254, and you're welcome to give us a call. Do any of you watch these so-called experts on TV and think, you know, that guy's really smart? And they put these people up because they're supposedly very smart, very intelligent, very politically savvy. And as you know, on Fox, Bill Kristol, boy, had a chance to run into him at an airport one time and have a talk with him. And you talk about an arrogant SOB. Anyway, Bill Kristol, who's on Fox quite a lot, and he's been hired by the New York Times as a columnist lately. Figure that one out. Bill Kristol oftentimes says things that don't work out so well. And via Digby, I found this morning over at Hullabaloo. And this fascinates me. Here's a quote from Bill Kristol. Everybody thinks he's so smart. He's just Mr. Fancy Pants smart. Really, really, really smart to hear all the conservatives talk about it, and the neocons. He's one of the main neocon group members, no question of it. Let me quote Mr. Kristol. He said, you know, Bill Clinton won a nomination in 1992 against a weak field. Mario Cuomo, the governor of New York, chose not to run. George Mitchell, the Senate Majority Leader, chose not to run. Al Gore and Dick Gebhardt, who had run in 88, chose not to run. The heavyweights didn't run. Bill Clinton had a sketchy field against him and won the nomination despite various missteps and flaws. And remember, this is a little while back. He says, Hillary Clinton, it looks like to me, is now going to follow in Bill Clinton's footsteps. If she gets a race against John Edwards and Barack Obama, she's going to be the nominee. Gore is the only threat to her, and she wants to be the centrist. Well, she goes on to say, Kristol goes on to say, I think she's taking some risk in staying on the center, not going to the left, which is intelligence. She can still beat the left-wing Democratic candidate, I think, and then she's pretty well positioned for the general election. So this is all good for Hillary Clinton. Barack Obama is not going to beat Hillary Clinton in a single Democratic primary. I'll predict that right now, says Mr. Smarty Pants Bill Kristol. So oftentimes when you see these gas bags on TV, and do remember that they're not nearly as smart as they like to think they are. Let's head on over to the phones. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, Guy. This is Malin, Jersey, calling from up in New Jersey.
Hey, good to hear from you.
Yeah, good to hear your voice. I was reading in the New York Times. It happened to be on the cover, but just when I went to write it down, the cover changes all the time, so I didn't get it. But I did read it pretty well. And they said that sales were up. Consumer confidence was up because sales were up from, you know, they're up to 0.4 from point whatever. Not enough to really make any difference. But they were happy also that they saw the fact people were spending more on other things other than just washing machines and, you know, things from Walmart and like that. And one of those things was gasoline, which was helping to drive up the sales of the economy.
Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, can you figure that one out?
That's kind of lame. that's kind of really lame.
That's really pushing it, isn't it?
I believe it is. Man, that's like somebody is about to be hanged. You got a good deal on the rope.
It makes you wonder how can they say things with a straight face like this, or how could the New York Times print something like this and not have a comment following?
Oh,
that,
yeah,
you know?
The editors, how they let that get through? You know, well, you know the old saying, was it liars figure and figures lie? And they've certainly stressed that one to his capacity. That's for sure.
And then something else which was not related to this particular article, which was when they give the cost of living, which is pretty much other things than food, and I'm not sure whether or not gasoline is part of that of the cost of living, but when they say that the cost of living has not increased, they're not including items that greatly bring it up. You know, if you add those other items, that they have a list of things, but they don't include the things that you would assume would be on there to make the economy seem as though, or make your living getting better, but it's not getting worse, not getting better, because things are turning the other direction. But that's just, I happened to notice that article, and it did seem funny that they used gas to bring up sales.
That's absurd, isn't it?
I know that Macy's is doing very badly up here in New Jersey area, and Macy's is sort of like they're a federated department store, and they tend to be a bellwether of what, because they're not a real expensive store, and they're not a cheap store, but they're laying off great numbers of people. And
yeah,
closing off different departments. So,
we have them here in South Florida. We have Macy's.
Yeah. I remember when I used to live, I lived down there for a year, and I worked in something called a Richards department store, and it was supposed to be federated. It was they change the names when they move out of state sometimes. But equivalent to that. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that to you because,
well, thanks. That's pretty interesting. It really is that they've stooped that low.
Another thing that this will be my last comment is that a lot. I think that something that hasn't hit the fan yet is so many people that live in the Northeast have these 1,000-gallon oil tanks. I don't know if you ever lived.
Oh, sure.
You lived up north. You know, you get oil for your heat, for baseboard heat, whatever, and. If you haven't had that shock yet of having it refilled, which I did like 2 months ago, for people that I only have a 500-gallon tank, but if you have a 1,000-gallon tank, it could almost make you have to go to the bank for a loan, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you're not on one of those things where they divide it up over the year, so you pay. A lot of people don't do that. And that could be a make-or-break thing for a lot of these people that can stay in their houses, and they haven't really had that happen to them yet.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
Great expense.
Yes.
I told Bob, I said, yeah, he's got it. He said he's got electric heat down there, so he has it pretty good. But when you got oil heat, I don't know. Just got to pay it. That's it.
And it's not going to be pleasant this coming year if it stays up there, and it's going to stay up there, and any doubt about it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. And you're, it's very interesting, this thing you're discussing on the the places in Iraq. But, I heard, I knew about, I've been watching this, these places grow and grow, the embassy, and I knew eventually it would have to come out. And they've been labeling them as temporary, but they're really not temporary. I've found that out. They're
sure.
It's just that it's COVID, more or less. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for your call. Good to hear
okay,
from you.
Guys.
Call anytime.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Ah, yes. Fuel oil tanks, yeah, I remember those big old fuel oil tanks. They used to be sitting on like four legs outside, the big old oval-shaped things and long, and yeah, can't imagine filling one of those babies up right now. Wow. 866-546-5254. We've got just a few minutes coming up until our interview with Elizabeth de la Vega to talk about the Kucinich actions taking place. Lieberman. Joe Lieberman. I saw Joe Lieberman on the tube again this morning while I was watching a little bit of news. What are they going to do about him? Does Harry Reid and the leadership and the Democratic, can't they just kick his ass out of their caucus? I understand. I know. I know about the politics and all that. But when we take over a bigger majority this next time around, they better think seriously about kicking Joe Lieberman, and maybe by then he will have got the message and quit the caucus and just go ahead and be a Republican. I'm sorry. I'm not one of those people that, and I'm not. You know I'm not. I have cut off my nose to spite my face several times, but just for the sake of getting that guy's vote, and I know some of you disagree vehemently over this, but I can't stand to have a man like that caucus with the Democrats. I wouldn't stand next to him. I would not. So I hope it can be that coming around the next time after we get the next group of senators sworn in, that maybe Harry Reid or whoever the Democratic majority leader, and I hope it's somebody other than Harry Reid, I hope they can go over and tell Joe Lieberman to get the hell out of the caucus. We don't want you here anymore. I certainly hope that is what will happen. And I think it could. I do think it could. I sure hope so. Anyway, we're going to pause for a break right now. We're going to get a hold of our next guest, who will be here, pretty doggone shortly, so don't go away. Elizabeth de la Vega, always somebody interesting to talk to, and we're going to talk to her about Dennis Kucinich's actions today.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come. And I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one. And I believe it could be someday it's going to come. And out on the edge of darkness, there I was a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. About the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. The peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Come on, the peace train. It's peace train holding roller.
Everyone jump on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Come on.
Peace train sounding louder.
Ah!
been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live and live? Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides the beast train. The beast train takes this country. Come take me home again. Oh, beast train sounding louder.
Back with you. Welcome back to the Guy James Show, everybody. So happy to have you along with us this afternoon. And as promised, we have along with us right now former federal prosecutor and author of the book U.S. v. George W. Bush, Elizabeth De La Vega. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
And before I go too far, I'm supposed to give you regards from a friend of yours and mine that we just talked to a short time ago on the program. Tom Engelhart was with us a little earlier today from TomDispatch.com, and he told me to pass on his best wishes. So,
that's very nice to hear.
There we go.
Same to him.
I called to have you on the program today because you have been very involved and done a lot of research and so forth over this impeachment question for several years now, actually. I forget what year the U.S. v. George Bush book came out, but I've got it sitting over there on the bookshelf. If I could make it over there, I'd look at the year on it right now. But I know you've kept up with this, and I know you've probably greatly interested in Dennis Kucinich's actions the other day, that something has finally been done. Where do you think this goes? And the bets are that it's not going to go anywhere, and I'm saying it probably won't, but I'm saying it still serves a very useful purpose.
Well, absolutely. As to the first part of your question, where do I think it will go? Obviously, I think that people on both sides of the aisle really just want it to go away. And it's gone to the committee now, and the guess is that they will take no action on it. However, Dennis Kucinich is quite admirably determined to keep this in the public view and to keep it before Congress, and he has stated now that he intends to bring it up again in 30 days, and he already has Wexler from Florida supporting him, and he has indicated that possibly others as well. So
I think I saw today where he told Conyers, if you don't take care of this at 35 counts, I'll be back with 60.
Exactly. So this is one of those inconvenient truths, I think, that is not going to go away, and I'm very grateful that we have those two at least, and I'm hoping that we have others. Because the fact of the matter is, it is absolutely worthwhile. Worthwhile is really putting it mildly. It's essential that we have this information before the public and that it gets heard in a way that's not the superficial discussion or ignoring of it that we have in the media right now.
Well, I don't know how, I think I know how you feel about it. With me, alright, I mean, my audience knows I do not like George Bush. But I do not feel impeachment should be used to get somebody. And I think this is far more important than just getting even with somebody or all that. This is important to the constitutional process that the founding fathers laid down. It has to be followed.
Well, absolutely right. When I wrote the book, which, by the way, it came out December 2006, I made that very point. And my book wasn't about impeachment, but it was about following the laws that we have in this country and the constitutional processes. And it's actually bothered me for many years to hear the way the president talks about justice as a prosecutor. It's really almost physically painful for me to hear him say we're going to, quote-unquote, bring people to justice as if it's some kind of a lynching or something. I don't think justice, that's not what justice means. It means holding people accountable and, in particular, in this instance, making sure that no person is above the law. And that's why I couldn't agree with you more. This isn't about vengeance or embarrassing someone or getting them, getting retribution. It's about following the law that we have in the country. It's really almost incredibly simple, actually.
Not only for just now, but for in the future. What if we get some despot someday? Well, what if? I think we already have. But what if we get somebody else that you know goes completely off the rails, even worse? I mean, we have to have a precedent set here where somebody down the line will say, "Hey, I dare not do that. I'll get impeached." But right now, I think the door's open to do just about anything we want in the executive branch.
Well, that's true, because I'm not sure how many people among your listeners were able to hear Dennis Kucinich reading his articles, and probably very few because it was not even announced in the media. And I
can tell you a lot of my listeners heard it.
Oh, good. Well,
oh, yeah.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad they were even able to know that it was going on.
Yes.
And because if you relied solely on the mainstream media, you wouldn't have been told about it, that's for sure. But it was a riveting reading of what really amounts to an almost mind-boggling array of crimes that have been committed by President Bush. And I don't use the term crime in a colloquial way as having been a prosecutor. I use it in a serious legal way. We have, if this were a situation of an indictment, we have overwhelming probable cause that he's committed all these crimes. So for Congress to just pretend that it's not happening means that they are basically watching crimes being committed and doing absolutely nothing about it.
For political purposes, really, what it boils
right,
down to.
Right, right. And so they are really no different. You know, many of the crimes that were committed by the president and that are still ongoing were done for political purposes. In large part, the war was for political purposes. It was for other purposes, too. But so while they criticize him for that, they are now doing exactly the same thing. They're failing to take action when action is required because they think it's a better political strategy. And I would bet that your listeners and millions and millions of people in this country don't even think it's a good political strategy.
I don't.
I think that airing these things would be a good political strategy.
I think the American public needs to hear every word of it. I think it has to be brought before them so that they can make a judgment on it if they don't know about it. But uh-huh. but it really needs to be brought forward to the entire public. And again, you know, like you said, I mean, it's not about a gotcha or anything like that. It's just so that people can know how much power this executive branch has taken. It's been a long uphill climb now for the executive office to grab more and more power, and I think they'd grab it all if they could. I really believe this White House would dismiss the Congress and the courts if they could.
Oh, absolutely. And there's so many components to it because, one, you have this egregious power grab. Two, you have the use of the government, the abuse of the government for not only their own political purposes, but also for the financial and other benefit of themselves and their associates. When you look at these no-bid contracts and so forth, it's mind-boggling, really, the amounts of money that have gone to the associates of the people in this administration. And actually, the people themselves, particularly Vice President Cheney, of course. So we have that as well. And these are actually precisely the same kind of allegations that were made against Governor Ryan from Illinois in the racketeering indictment, which Patrick mm-hmm. Fitzgerald prosecuted. The same kind of abuse and use and abuse of the official position.
Do you think Patrick Fitzgerald, when called to testify in front of Congress, will he, from a legal standpoint, will he be able to divulge the interviews that he had with Cheney and Bush and be able to let any of that out publicly?
Boy, I would really have to I could give you an off-the-cuff answer, but I would really have to look into that to answer it accurately, because there are some ins and outs as to whether he could do that or not.
I think his testimony could be one of the most interesting things we've heard in a long, long time in front of the Congress. But I don't know what he's predisposed to want to say. He's been
right,
very...
and not only well. I actually, you know, this is purely speculation. I think he's predisposed to want to tell the absolute truth, I actually have no doubt about that. But the question is what he will be allowed to testify about, what areas he would be allowed to testify about.
Well, despite problems and abuses that we've had in the not so distant future with a special prosecutor. Do you think that that's something that should be brought back for things like this?
Yes, I absolutely think it should be brought back, because I don't really see any other way to deal with this kind of abuse. And the idea, for example, that we have now people in the Department of Justice investigating the very same people who they are reporting to is just absurd. And it was only because there was a special prosecutor in the Nixon case that we were able to get anywhere with that. And certainly Kenneth Starr does not provide a sterling example of a special prosecutor. But the fact that there was one bad one, I don't think really should be reason for us not to have the process in place.
Sure. Well, this Justice Department is owned lock, stock, and barrel by the White House, and has no obviously has no intention, even with the new AG we got, still marching to the White House's drumbeat, and we have ample evidence of that. Elizabeth, I want to. Where do you think this is going to go? It's probably going to be laid on the table, right? And that's going to be the end of it. But hopefully, Dennis. I know Dennis. he's a guy that you don't want on you. I mean, he's a guy that he's a pit bull.
Well, you know, people always ask where it's going to go, and I really don't want to say, oh, it's not going anywhere. I don't think that we can say that. And I think that what I hope people who feel that it should go somewhere will do is to continue to press for it, because we need every single person in this country who feels that this administration has been doing so many wrong things in our name to stand up and say that.
Sure.
And I think we should all do it, and the more people who do it, the more we'll add on. And so... I'm not going to try to predict the outcome of this.
Well,
it's going to keep pushing along for people to do the right thing.
I sure hope it does, and I wish Dennis the best with it. And I know, and you know, and I know that if this were all laid on the table, the whole sordid scene, everything mm-hmm. that if this were laid out in front of the entire public. They'd be having what I like to call one of those Scooby-Doo moments, you know, huh? I really believe if the public knew everything, that probably Dennis Kucinich knows, and those of us who consider ourselves activists, I think the public would have a fit. But you know how it is; the public doesn't know, and in a lot of cases doesn't want to know. But
right, and I would bet that most people in the mainstream media who are supposedly reporting on this haven't even read those articles.
Right, exactly right.
Because I've noticed that they keep saying, well, there's this, they name about three things, and then they say, and so on.
Right.
Well, anybody who can yawn and say, and so on, when we're talking about things like imprisoning children as young as 10 years old and torturing people and... losing billions and billions of dollars in Iraq is either an incredibly cavalier and venal person, or they're simply not paying attention.
Oh, sure. And not paying attention is one of the big problems we have right now. What's the old saying? The evils of government are directly proportional to the tolerance of the people.
And, right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly what we're stuck with. Elizabeth, thanks so much for being on the program today. As always, and we enjoy having you on and hearing your take on all this. And we shall We shall stay apprised of the situation. I know you will as well, and we'll talk again in the future.
All right, great. Thanks
so much.
And thanks for a great show.
Thank you. Well, I had several people call me and write me and everything else and want to know if I'd seen the Dan Rather address last week in front of the National Conference for Media Reform. And I did, of course, see it. But I think it's something, and although it's lengthy, it's something I think you all should hear. Dan Rather, one of my heroes in the media, a guy that got an extremely raw deal. And bear with me on this. This lasts a while, but this is an interesting talk by Dan Rather. And by the way, it's at the Conference for Media Reform last week up in Minneapolis.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I trust all of you know what Abe Lincoln said about overly generous introductions such as that one. Honest Abe said, never take time to deny it. The audience will find out soon enough for themselves. And so it will be with you tonight. I'm grateful to be here, and I am most of all gratified by the energy that I've seen tonight at this conference. My friends, it will take that kind of energy and more to sustain what is good in our news media, to improve what is deficient, and to push back against the forces and the trends that imperil journalism and that by immediate extension imperil freedom and democracy itself. The framers of our Constitution enshrined freedom of the press in the very First Amendment, up at the top of the Bill of Rights, not because they were fans of journalism. Like many politicians then and now, they were not, but rather because they knew, as Thomas Jefferson put it, that if a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. And it is because of this constitutionally protected and guaranteed role that I still prefer to use the word press over the word media. If nothing else, it serves as a subtle reminder that along with newspapers, radio, television, and now the internet, carry the same constitutional rights, mandates, and responsibilities that the founders guaranteed for those who plied their trade solely in print. So when you hear me talk about the press, please know that I'm talking about all the ways that news can be transmitted. And by the way, when you hear me criticize and critique the press, please know that I do not accept myself from these criticisms. In our efforts to take back the American press for the American people, we are blessed this weekend with the gift of good timing. For anyone who may have been inclined to ask if there really is a problem with the news media, or wonder if the task of media reform is indeed an urgent one, recent days have brought an inescapable answer from a most unlikely source. A source who decided to tell everyone, quote, what happened? I know I can't be the first person this weekend to reference the recent book by former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan, but having interviewed him this last week, I think there's some very important points to be made from the things he says in the book and the questions his statements raise. I'm sure of all of you took special notice of what he had to say about the role of the press corps in the run-up to the war in Iraq. In the government's selling of the war, in McClellan's phrase, marketing of the war, he said they were, or I should say, we in the press were, quote, complicit enablers, and, quote, overly deferential, end quote. These are interesting statements, especially considering the source. As one tries to wrap one's mind around them, the phrase cognitive dissonance comes to mind, that is, two different opposite reactions. The first reaction is a visceral one. It is, Whatever his motives for saying these things, he's right, and we didn't need Scott McClellan to tell us so. But the second reaction is, wait a minute. I do remember that at least some reporters and some news organizations asking tough questions, asking them of the president, of those in the administration, of White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, and, oh, yes, of Scott McClellan himself, once he took over from Mr. Fleischer. A few months after the invasion, the McClatchy newspapers, for example, asked some of the tough questions. So how do we reconcile these competing reactions? Well, we need to pull back for what we call in television the wide shot. If we look at the wide shot, we can see in one corner of our screen the White House briefing room filled with the White House press corps, and filling the rest of the screen, the finite but disproportionately powerful universe that has become known as mainstream media, the newspapers and news programs, real and alleged, that employ these White House correspondents, the news organizations that are in turn owned by a shockingly few much larger corporations, for which news is but a minuscule part of their overall business interests. In the wake of 9/11 and in the run-up to Iraq, these news organizations made a decision, consciously or unconsciously, but unquestionably in a climate of fear, to accept the overall narrative frame given them by the White House, a narrative that went like this. Saddam Hussein, brutal dictator, harbored weapons of mass destruction, and because of his supposed links to Al-Qaeda, this could not be tolerated in a post-9/11 world. In the news and on the news, one could, to be sure, find persons and views that did not agree with all or parts of this official narrative. Hans Blix, the former U.N. weapons inspector, comes to mind as an example. But the burden of proof, implicitly or explicitly, was put on these dissenting views in person. The burden of proof was not put on an administration that was demonstrably moving toward the large-scale military action that would represent a break with American precedent and stated policy of how, when, and under what circumstances this nation goes to war. So with this in mind, we look back to the corner of the screen where the White House press corps is asking their questions. I was a White House correspondent for 10 years, and I have worked with some of the best in the business. You have an incentive when you are in that briefing room to ask the good, tough questions. There is an incentive. If nothing else, that is how you get in the paper or on the air. There's more to it than that, and things certainly have changed since I was a White House correspondent. Something I want to talk to you about in a minute. But the correspondents, the really good ones, these correspondents ask their tough questions. And these questions are met with what is now called, euphemistically and much too kindly, what is now called message discipline. Well, we used to have a better and more accurate term for message discipline. We called it stonewalling, or something more direct. Now, cut back, remembering television's wide shot. Now cut back to your evening news or your daily newspaper, where that White House correspondent dutifully repeats the question he asked of the president or his press secretary and dutifully relates the answer he was given, the same non-answer that we already heard dozens of times, which amounts to a pitch for the administration's point of view, whether or not the answer had anything to do with the actual question that was asked. And then, thank you, Jack. Now, in other news today, and we're off on a whole new story. In our news media, in our press, those who wield power were, in the lead-up to the Iraq War, given the opportunity to present their views as a coherent whole, to connect the dots as they saw the dots and connections. No matter how much these views may have flown in the face of precedent, established practice, or indeed the facts, as we are reminded yet again by the just-released Senate report on the administration's use of pre-war intelligence. The powerful are given this opportunity still, in ways big and small, despite what you may hear about the post-Katrina press. But when a tough question is asked and not answered, when reputable people come before the public and say, wait a minute, something's not right here, the press has treated them like voices crying in the wilderness. These views, though they might be given airtime, become lone dots, dots that journalists all too often do not dare connect, even if the connections are obvious, even if people on the Internet and the independent press are making these very same connections. The mainstream press doesn't connect these dots because someone might then accuse them of editorializing or of being the, quote, liberal media or unpatriotic. But connecting these dots, making disparate facts make sense, is a big part of what is supposed to be the real work of journalism. So how does this happen? How does it happen? Why does this happen? Let me say by way of answering that good journalism starts with an owner who has guts and a sense of public service. In a news organization whose owner has guts, there is an incentive to ask tough questions, and there is incentive to pull together the facts, to connect the dots in a way that makes coherent sense to the news audience. I mentioned a moment ago that things have changed since I was a White House correspondent. Yes, presidential administrations have become more adept at holding access over the heads of reporters. You ask a tough question, or too many of them, so the implicit threat goes, and you're not going to get any more interviews with high-ranking members of the administration, let alone the president. But I was covering Presidents Johnson, Nixon, and Ford, men not known as exactly pushovers. No, what has changed, even more than the nature of the presidency, is the character and the actions of news ownership. I only found out years after the fact, for example, about the pressure that the Nixon White House put on my then bosses during Watergate, that widespread criminal conspiracy that was based in the Oval Office itself. Pressure to cut down my pieces, to call me off the story, and so on. Because back then, my bosses took the heat, so I didn't have to. They did this so the story could get told and so the public could be informed. But it is rare now to find a major news organization owned by an individual, someone who can say, in effect, the buck stops here. The more likely motto now is, the news stops with making bucks. America's biggest, most important news organizations in the main and on the whole have, over the past 25 years, fallen prey to merger after merger, acquisition after acquisition, to the point where they are now tiny parts of immeasurably larger corporate entities, entities whose primary business often has nothing to do with news. entities that may, at any given time, have literally hundreds of regulatory and or legislative issues before multiple arms of the government concerning a vast array of business interests. These are entities that, as publicly held and traded corporations, have as their overall reigning mandate provide a return on shareholder value, increase profits, and not over time, not over the long haul, but quarterly. One might ask just where the news fits into this model. And if you really need an answer, you can turn on your television where you will see the following. Political analysis reduced to in-studio shouting matches between partisans armed with little more than the day's talking points. Precious time and resources wasted on so-called human interest stories, celebrity fluff, sensational trials, and gossip. A proliferation of news you can use that amounts to thinly disguised press releases for the latest consumer products. And though this doesn't get said enough, local newscasts, which is where most Americans get their news, that seems not to change no matter what town or city you're in. So slavish is its adherence to the happy talk formula and the dictum that if it bleeds, it leads. And if you lead with or even spend much time on international stories, you, your ratings, and your program die. I could continue for hours, I know you'd be relieved to know that I won't, cataloging journalistic sins of which I know you're all too aware. But as the time and this hour grows late, let me say that almost all of these failings come down to this. In the current model of corporate news ownership, the incentive to produce good and valuable news is simply not there. Good journalism, quality news of integrity, good journalism and quality news of integrity requires resources and it requires talent. These things are expensive. These things eat away at the bottom line. Years ago, in the 80s and 90s, when the implications of these cost-trimming measures were becoming impossible to ignore, and the quality of the news was clearly threatened, I and others spoke out against this cutting of news operations to the bone and beyond. Even then, though, I could not have imagined that the cost-cutting imperatives would go as far as they have today. Deep into the marrow of what was once considered a public trust. But since the financial resources always seem to be available for entertainment, promotion, and last but not least, for lobbying, perhaps there's an even more important reason why the incentive to produce quality news is absent, and that is quality news of integrity, by its very nature, is sure to rock the boat now and then. Good, responsible, newsworthy of its constitutional protections, news will, in that famous phrase, afflict the powerful and comfort the afflicted. And that, when one feels the need to deliver shareholder value above all, means that good news may not always mean good business. Or so goes the fear, a fear that filters down into just about every big newsroom in this country. Now, I've spent my entire life in for-profit news, and I happen to believe, on the basis of my experience, that it does not have to be this way. I have worked for news owners who, while they may have regarded their news divisions as an occasional irritant, chose to turn that irritant into a pearl of public trust. But today, sadly, it seems that the conglomerates that have control over some of the biggest pieces of this public trust would just as soon spit that irritant out. So what does this mean for us tonight, and what is to be done? It means that we need to be on the alert for where, when, and how our news media bows to undue government influence. And you, need to let news organizations know in no uncertain terms that you won't stand for it, that you, as news consumers, are capable of exerting pressure of your own. It means that we need to continue to let our government know that when it comes to media consolidation, enough is enough. Too few voices are dominating, homogenizing, and marginalizing the news. We need to demand that the American people get something in exchange for the use of airways that belong, after all, to the people. It means that we need to ensure that the Internet, where free speech reigns and where journalism does not have to pass through a corporate filter, remains free. We need to say loud and clear that we don't want big corporations enjoying preferred access to our government, acting as the gatekeeper for this unique platform for independent journalism, the Internet. And it means that we need to hold the government to its mandate to protect the freedom of the press, including independent and non-commercial news media. We need to make hold the government to both the idea and the ideal that the red beating heart of freedom and democracy is a free, truly free, and independent, yes, fiercely independent when necessary, press. The stakes could not possibly be higher. Scott McLellan's book serves as a reminder. And the current election season, not to mention the gathering clouds of conflict over Iran, will both serve as tests of whether lessons have truly been learned from past experience. Ensuring that a free press remains free will require vigilance, and it will require work. Please, take tonight's energy and inspiration home with you. Take it back to your desks and your workplaces, to your colleagues and your fellow citizens. Magnify it, multiply it, and spread it. Make it viral. Make it something that cannot be ignored, not by the powers in Washington, not by the owners and executives of media companies. Write these people. Call them. Send them the message loud, clear, and often that you know your rights. You know that you are entitled to news media as diverse and varied as the American people, and that you deserve a press that provides the raw material of democracy, the good information that Americans need to be full participants in our government of, by, and for the people.
Thank you, Dan Rather. A great speech. He lays it all out, what exactly is wrong with the press in this country today, the media. We do not have a full operating media in this country. It is a shame. I've long trumpeted those remarks that he has made. You and I, so many of us agree on that, that the media is not near what it needs to be, what it should be. Didn't start out as necessarily just a profit-making enterprise, but something to inform the people and help keep our democracy here. That's all for today. Thank you so much for listening to the Guy James Show. We're happy to have you with us, as always. Trying to find our goodbye music. Here we go. Don't forget, you're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Hit On Radio Network, and you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left.